Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro and the studios of WMOT-FM. The introduction of a bill in the Tennessee General Assembly to prohibit a student from being admitted to a public college or university in the state unless that student can establish U.S. citizenship or legal residence has brought the issue of higher education for all kinds of international students, immigrants, undocumented aliens, people here on student visas, and others to the fore. We're using this particular measure, which has been tabled until 2010 in subcommittee in the House, as a jumping-off point to discuss the broader matter with Dr. Laura Blackwell Clark, Assistant Professor of Educational Leadership at MTSU. She testified against the bill before a State House subcommittee on April 7th. Her views, as expressed on this program, are strictly her own and not necessarily those of MTSU, the College of Education and Behavioral Science, or any organization with which she is associated. Dr. Clark, thanks for being here with us today.
Good morning, Jenna, and thank you for inviting me.
The two major arguments on behalf of legislation like this go something like, why should the taxpayers fund the college education of people who might be here illegally? And don't these students take up slots in colleges that would have been occupied by native-born Tennesseans and or Americans, like my kid? Could you take each of those assertions in turn and address them?
I'll be happy to talk about that. We can look at those answers from a couple of perspectives, but I'll start first with the economic perspective regarding paying taxes and paying for public services. People who are living in the United States, whether here legally or here undocumented, contribute to our tax base in a number of ways. They pay taxes through their rental, their rent every month. They pay taxes when they make purchases in the local community. They pay wheel taxes when they buy the tags for their automobiles. And they contribute in a number of ways. And that's a misunderstanding on the part of people when they believe that people do not pay taxes if they are undocumented and in the country. So they are definitely contributing taxpayers in our community. And then economically, regarding the taking the place of another Tennessee resident in college, I'm not aware of many college programs right now who are seeking to build enrollment, who are willing to turn down a person unless they do not meet the academic criteria for admission.
Or the financial criteria, ability to pay.
Or the financial ability to pay. And so I don't think that argument holds water. Now, I've not looked at numbers to back that up with numbers. I just know that the spirit of universities in Tennessee is to build enrollment. And so in that light, I don't see that as a valid argument.
MTSU certainly has had a policy of attempting to sustain modified enrollment growth from year to year. I know this from looking at the semester-to-semester statistics. It is a goal of the administration, or at least has been ever since I've been here.
Yes. And then I'd like to address that also, those two questions, from another perspective, and it's a broader social perspective. We have residents in our community, and some are legal United States citizens, some are not. However, they're all residents in our community, and some undocumented people have been here, children particularly, for most of their lives. If they are 17 years old, they've often been here since they were age 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. So in essence, they only know the American life. They do not know the culture from which they came. Therefore, they're part of our community. They're part of our society. And as educators, as educational institutions, as state government, we should feel compelled to provide education for all of the residents of Tennessee, regardless of their immigration status. We, in a social justice note, we owe that to people, to the polity. However, in an economic, a broader economic view, we owe it to our economy to prepare our citizens to leave high school, to graduate college, and enter the workforce as productive income-generating citizens.
All I've been hearing for the past 40 years from every reliable source is that a high school education is not enough. It hasn't been enough virtually since the day I was born in 1957. A college education is virtually essential in the job market today.
It is essential at minimum in simply opening more doors. We know plenty of people who have who are productive people without a college degree. However, the college degree opens doors for people. I had a conversation with a young 10-year-old boy this week who is undocumented because his parents are undocumented. And, of course, he has no control over that. And I asked him in a conversation, first, how are you doing in school? Oh, I make A's and B's. And then I say, and he's fifth grade. I say, do you want to go to college? Oh, yes. And I say, why do you want to go to college? I want a better job. And so young children, particularly if they're watching their parents struggle in employment, they know early on and they want and they aspire to employment and education, which enables them to gain that employment.
That's a great degree of maturity and awareness in a 10-year-old child.
But he said it with certainty, and he said it very quickly.
There is a court precedent, I believe 1982 is the year, that establishes residency as the qualifying factor for K through 12 public education of a child, not country of origin. Is that court precedent applicable to higher education? And if not, why not?
It is not applicable to higher education. The Pyler decision in 1982 addressed what we affectionately call lower ed, which is K-12. Mm-hmm. And it was based on the principle that children who come into this country and who are living in this country, we owe the basic education to them, and whether they are citizens or not. And so that decision was made based on the realization, the recognition that education in the level of elementary, middle, and high school is a basic life necessity in the United States. It does not apply to higher ed legally, and in the eyes of some people in other ways, but certainly legally it does not apply because we still do not consider in a broad way the higher education and a college degree as a basic necessity.
Should we expand it to not only higher ed, but also for people for whom college is not necessarily a good option based on their personality, level of intelligence, and skills, also to the two-year community colleges and the technical vocational schools as well?
Most certainly, because everyone has different needs, different learning styles, different gifts, different talents. Some are academic, some are not academic, some are more vocational in nature. And however, they all need further education for development. Yes, we should certainly include this discussion to reference the vocational schools and the two-year schools as well.
Now, I know you're not a lawyer, but if it is extended to higher education, that is to say residency as the qualifying factor instead of country of origin, does that make a college education, or I should say higher education beyond K through 12, a right instead of a privilege? Is higher ed a right that to which people should be entitled provided they have the grades and the financial wherewithal?
I choose not to use the word right. I choose to use the word opportunity. And I like that word better because we say the door is open if you choose to walk through it, because rather than a sense of entitlement.
Mm-hmm. So they would have the right to an equal opportunity if they choose to avail themselves of the opportunity.
They would have the opportunity to further their education and to gain a degree which would open more doors for them. And I'd like to make reference again back to the Pyler decision. The definition of residence in the case of Pyler, mm-hmm, was simply the place in which the child resided, not country of origin. So that means that If they reside in Murfreesboro City Schools, they have the opportunity to attend Murfreesboro City Schools. It is that definition of residence that I would like to see applied to higher ed. It is discouraged right now under the a federal act of 1996. States are discouraged from allowing in-state tuition for undocumented students. And in fact, they are discouraged by the imposition of a penalty, and that is if they give out-of-state tuition to undocumented students, then they must also give it to any U.S. citizen who is out-of-state. And so that's discouraging to a lot of universities, obviously, to do it like that. But still, we would like to see the continuation of the definition of residence applied to higher ed, which means simply, where do you live? And that then we consider that residence. What, but it is not at this time.
What will that take? Will it take state-by-state legislation? Will it take federal legislation? Will it take a Supreme Court decision?
It will take state-by-state legislation because the function of education lies in the hands of states. The U.S. Constitution, when it was written, did not address education. There is no mention of education in the U.S. Constitution, but there is the clause that says whatever is not addressed here will be given as a responsibility to the states. Therefore, from that point on, states assume the responsibility for education. Federal government can influence states and educational decisions through funding. The
sort of
federal
a carrot and the stick approach.
Correct. Here's our money if you do it our way.
Right.
But there are some other broader ways that that federal influence comes into play, and it is in the area of civil law, civil rights, more human issues. If it's specifically education decisions, it lies in the hands of state lawmakers. But if it's broader issues, then the Supreme Court can come into the picture, U.S. Congress can come into the picture, as they have with the reintroduction of the 2009 DREAM Act, which was reintroduced in March of this year in Congress.
And what does the DREAM Act provide for?
The DREAM Act is, let's see if I can recall these words, Development, Relief, and Education of Alien Minors, DREAM. It offers a way, it offers a procedure, a pathway for minors who graduate from U.S. schools to choose to enter the U.S. system to become fingerprinted, to enter the system, to get a temporary green card in order to enter either our public education higher ed system or to enter the U.S. military. And they can have this opportunity if they have demonstrated good academic records, good behavior records, good moral character, and if they enter the U.S. at age 15 or younger. And if they choose to do this and enter this pathway through the DREAM Act, they can acquire the education as an in-state resident, if the state chooses to define it like that, and they can complete their education and at that point be eligible for a permanent green card.
And since this would entail the acquisition of this data about them, including the fingerprints, it could also become a path to citizenship if the person wants to be a naturalized citizen.
Most certainly. Yes, it would be a path to citizenship. And the period of time between the time they entered and got the permanent green card, they would have a temporary green card, temporary legal permanent resident status.
Do you think that people would overcome their fear of the INS and deportation and being discovered, because it very much still is a sort of a clandestine society, because people do have that fear? Will they overcome that if the bill passes enough to take advantage of it?
That will be a concern for many families. At this time, however, the families are already participating in our education system to that degree because their children are enrolled in schools. And so to that degree, we are aware of them. And in this case, the information would be collected on the child or the 18-year-old, and not necessarily on the families, but by association, of course. You know, families might be concerned. It would be something to overcome. But as people saw these children walking through this door of opportunity and getting good results, I think it would be less of a concern. It would be seen as a way for children to get out of the place between a rock and a hard place where they are right now simply because of their parents' documentation, their parents' status, I should say. The children could take another path.
There was an article recently in the Tennessean that stated that Republicans in the state legislature, the major sponsors of legislation that would change Tennessee's immigration laws, have had difficulty getting traction for them, largely because of the economy.
Yes.
And that article cited a 2008 MTSU poll that found that 47% of respondents, and these are people who were interviewed in the state of Tennessee, favor a guest worker program that would give undocumented aliens a path to citizenship. That's 47%. It's in the state of Tennessee. This is not a national poll. So again, is this a sign that tensions toward immigrants are easing, or is it a sign that the economy just overwhelms everyone's thoughts right now?
The economy is certainly number one on most of our minds, and I know that it's a priority in the legislative thinking right now. I've been working over the last couple months with legislators. I've been in conversation with them regarding this legislation, and they will, across the board, tell you, if there's a fiscal note attached to this bill, it's likely to die, because they are concerned, and they have to be concerned with the economy and the cost of the legislation. So yes, the economy is priority right now. The 47% is an interesting figure, because that it's hard to read surveys. I'd have to know more about who conducted the survey, what population they surveyed, to really know more about what that says to us.
It was a randomly conducted survey by students in Mass Comm under the direction of their journalism professors by telephone of people in adult residents of Davidson, Williamson, and Rutherford counties.
Very interesting.
47% is not a plurality, but it is a substantial number, I think.
I agree, it's substantial. And it certainly does give, if it was a random sample, it gives us a glimpse into the thinking of Middle Tennesseans. And we address urban, we address suburban, and perhaps some rural thinking as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, and I think legislators should take note of that.
Speaking of cost, you mentioned fiscal notes. The bill that we started talking about at the beginning, the one that is now dead in the General Assembly to prohibit undocumented people from other countries to enter public universities in Tennessee, it had a fiscal note attached to it. It would have increased state expenditures by $128,000 in one-time revenues and $1,024,000 in recurring revenues, because it would have required the hiring of additional state employees and the purchasing of equipment to keep up with all the documentation, office furniture, so forth and so on. So is this idea dying for lack of support, or is it dying for lack of support of the concept, or dying for lack of support of the spending? That's really what I'm curious about.
Well, I'm not on the committees that vote, mm-hmm. and I don't know the thinking of the reason the people voted why they did.
Mm-hmm.
I just know I was repeatedly told in many conversations that if there is a cost associated, it will not pass this year. So that doesn't allow us to really know if it's also dying because there's lack of interest.
Mm-hmm.
I do know there is an effort by members of the Senate and House, because I've had conversations with both. There's an effort to form a comprehensive Tennessee immigration reform package. They're hopefully going to present it next year. I have this week been invited to be in on the conversations to develop this package for the comprehensive immigration reform, because I offered myself as a resource on education issues, and they said, please, we'd like for you to be at the table. So I will learn more over the next few months as far as how that process goes. But there have been a number of immigration bills introduced in many areas, in employment, in education, in a number of different subcommittees. And what these people are trying to do that are forming the comprehensive package is to, rather than have a piecemeal approach, have more of a comprehensive look at the issue. And I support that.
You work with organizations that help Latinos here in the state of Tennessee. What do Latinos tell you about how they are treated by Caucasian Tennesseans, African-American Tennesseans, in the store, in the school, in the church, the everyday Joe on the street? Are they treated with respect? Are they treated with dignity? Do they encounter confrontational people? How do they feel?
That's a very broad question. And I would say that they are treated, you name several groups here. Mm-hmm. It runs the gamut. It runs the spectrum in each group. I hear stories of treatment, I'll say police officers, mm-hmm. police officers. I hear stories of treatment of police officers treating Latinos with respect, with courtesy, stopping to help and being wonderful, helpful people. And then I hear other stories, as we've heard in Nashville, under the 287G program, of police officers being misinformed, not understanding correct identification and taking people into custody, maybe even arresting, mm-hmm. And finding in the end that it was all misfounded. So that's one story. As far as people in different ethnic groups, different races, Latinos are like we are. They have different experiences based on the setting they're in, based on where they're coming from, based on the particular person they encounter. And we have to remember that within Latino groups, there are many, many, many subcultures, right. just as there are in America.
Of course. Mexicans have a different culture from Salvadorans, who have a different
Correct.
Culture from Guatemalans and so forth.
Yes.
This is a great deal to learn for a region of the country, the South, that for eons had only Caucasian Americans and African Americans and had a great deal of difficulty living together in that society with relatively few other races or cultures living
yes.
amongst them.
Yes. And when we increase our diversity, it makes for advantages and in some cases problems. So, you know, that certainly is happening in Middle Tennessee right now. The advantages are we grow to know more people and we learn more about ourselves when we get to know people of other cultures.
And although there may be growing pains, though, overall this is a very healthy thing for everyone concerned.
It's healthy for everyone because, as I say, we get to meet more people, but truly we learn more about ourselves and our own perspective mm-hmm. when we meet people from other parts of the world.
Do you think people are aware of the fact that maintaining undocumented aliens in this sort of clandestine nether region where they have to negotiate sort of an obstacle course with local, state, and federal entities creates sort of a permanent underclass that it stymies upward mobility legislation like this. It stymies the opportunity of which we Americans are so proud as part of our heritage and the reason for the country's very existence. Do you think people get that, or is the motivation behind legislation like this too visceral to take that into consideration?
What I repeatedly hear as a motivation for pushing this legislation is the phrase, they're breaking the law. They're breaking the law. And so that is difficult to for many people to understand that, first of all, the immigrant population come to the U.S. to find a better life. to find a better life for their families. And many times we are compelled to do that, and it will cause us maybe to overlook some other things that we should do. But when the Latinos that I know come here, they do everything they can within their that they are able to do to follow the law, to get documentation, to get IDs, to car tags, to pay income tax when they work, to do all of that to follow the law. And the fact that they are not documented with legal status does prohibit them from going through many doors. It does create, it does block them and does create an underclass if they cannot break out of that. It's very, very difficult. But a characteristic I've seen and admired in almost every case is a personal characteristic of resilience. And this resilience takes them through the hard times, and because they want to do it for their family. They are very, very family-oriented. They live their life, craft their life, make their decisions based on what's good for their family. Mm-hmm. And their family may be their wife or husband and children who are right here. Their family may be their parents who are in Mexico. Their family may be their extended family in Venezuela, or their sisters and brothers in Honduras. So family is a real driving factor, and resilience to get past the hard times is another one. It's a lesson that many of us could learn from.
And a part of that resilience is an abiding belief not only in the economic value of an education, but in the intrinsic value of an education toward making one a more well-rounded, more well-developed human being.
Education, but I was speaking more generally there just of making a better life, mm-hmm. being in the U.S., mm-hmm. employment, education opportunities. They know their children can go to good schools here. Mm-hmm. They know that there are job opportunities here, even in this recession. Mm-hmm. You know, the drive to make a better life is actually what we as humans do. We look to make a better life for ourselves and for our family and our children.
Are you doing any pedagogical research along these lines?
I am beginning a study here at MTSU in which I will take a look at our 500 students who claim Hispanic heritage. I know that we have more than that because some do not check the box, as we say, when they do their admission forms. But we do know that we have at least 500 here. And my work is going to first take mostly a qualitative look through interviews and observation at the college experience of our students here who are Latino. I'm basing my work on the work of Christina Gomez at Northeastern Illinois University, who did an interview study of Latino students, and on the work of Patricia Gondara in California, who's a preeminent researcher in Latino education. They have discovered qualities, as I mentioned, resilience, and a couple some other qualities they've mentioned that I'm going to address in my research and I'm going to look for are things like the presence of a mentor in a student's life and the effect of a good mentor, and then the personal resilience in college life, the resilience it takes simply to get into college,
right.
Then to find a social network in college, to navigate the academic issues in college, and to finish and graduate in college. It takes resilience. We also are going to look at the experience of living in bicultures, being a bicultural person. They are American in many ways, and they are their native culture in other ways. And then the last feature we're going to look at is development of their identity, their personal individual identity. How does that come about, and from where does it come? And so those things are what I will look at in interviews with students here. And if we still have unanswered questions, we may broaden the study if there are some other places interested in Tennessee, you know, for us to come and look and talk to and learn about their Latino students in colleges.
So this may involve eventually partnerships with other institutions? Or
it could. It could. We want to start here and get a picture of our students here. In meeting students this year, we have some of the most fascinating, energetic, interesting Latino students right here on campus. And I can't wait to sit and have the conversation with them.
How long do you envision the study taking, over what period of time?
An academic year. We'll get it really rolling by the time school starts next year and wrap it up sometime in the spring semester.
It will be fascinating. Will you come back and talk to us about the results when you've concluded your research?
I would be happy to do that.
Thank you. Dr. Laura Blackwell Clark, who is an assistant professor of educational leadership here at MTSU. I'm Jenna Logue. This is MTSU on the Record. We invite you to join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at mtsunews.com at your leisure. And we're also available on iTunes.